Today we are talking with Philip Gounev about his new book, Corruption and Organized Crime in Europe. He is the co-author of this book with Vincenzo Ruggiero, and they have a number of people who have made contributions to individual chapters. This is a great combination of two researchers' skills. Professor Ruggiero is a major theorist on the topic of organized crime, and Philip is a leading researcher into corruption in Europe. The issue of corruption is always timely. It may be that in a global financial crisis, the consequences of corrupt practices have even greater impact. The authors focus on the connection between corruption and organized crime, especially how these two concepts interact in a marketplace. Organized criminals need security to ensure stable operations, and the public officials can provide that security through corrupt practices. I do a great deal of research into corruption and organized crime, but I still learn an enormous amount from this book. Any researchers in this area from the English-speaking world will benefit from reading this book, as about half of their references come from non-English-speaking sources. Thus, this is an opportunity to see data and theories that you would otherwise not have the chance to read in English. I really enjoyed both reading this book and talking with Philip. I hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome to New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm the co-host, Mark Locks, recording here from Brisbane in Australia. And today we're talking with Philip Gounev about his new book, Corruption and Organized Crime in Europe. And Philip's in Sofia in Bulgaria right now. So, Philip, just to get us started, do you want to just fill us in on a bit of your background and then how you came to write this book with Vincenzo Ruggiero?
Yep. Well, I've been doing research for about a decade on organized crime here in Bulgaria. And it's one of the, particularly the corruption is one of the big issues in Bulgaria, and it's one of the main instruments that organized crime uses. And we've done a lot of research here in Bulgaria on the use of corruption by organized crime. And we started that probably in the 90s. It was almost too dangerous to write about it and to do research. So similarly to Russia, where probably it still is dangerous. And we started in the very late 90s to do this type of research. We started first with some studies on border corruption, and we published kind of the menu and the rates of the customs and border guard officers for anything you wanted to smuggle, and we got the bribe rates and all that stuff. And it was really under the pressure of the European Union and NATO accession processes that we were able to start writing about these things. But for many years, and even until very recently, it was so much on the surface, corruption and even organized criminals are more or less celebrities in Bulgaria, that it allowed us to develop a very good understanding of both organized crime and the way it uses corruption, even without being part of the law enforcement community. And police officers were also fairly corrupt. For many years, they were speaking to us very openly. We were in a very privileged situation in Bulgaria, unlike many other parts of Europe, to do research on these issues. So when in 2008, the European Commission decided to do a similar study on all of Europe, and they had a public tender, we were naturally in a very good position. My institute, the Center for the Study of Democracy, had developed some of the most detailed knowledge on the subject. So we won this tender, and we won the contract to do this study throughout Europe. Basically, that's kind of the background and how we got into this whole field.
Right. So this actual book is the product of that study.
So yeah, the book it built, of course, that was the background, the glue that the study was pretty much the glue that put it together. It allowed us to on the one hand to find local experts, because there are many issues on law enforcement that could be researched from outside consultants like ourselves. But corruption, it's a social phenomenon that requires and its relation with organized crime, and it's the use by organized crime requires a very detailed historical and cultural knowledge that we couldn't naturally have for all 27 EU member states. So it allowed us to go and search for experts in each EU member state that could write about it. The peculiar thing was that in quite a few EU member states, there was really no one that could outside the law enforcement community, and certainly no academics that could really write about this topic. It was something that academics were kept aside from, even in big countries like Germany or France. It was very difficult to find someone that could that really understood organized crime and understood its mechanics and could from an academic standpoint write about corruption. And I actually confronted several well-known academics, researchers on corruption, because in every country we found someone who could say, yeah, I'm an expert on corruption. I'm an academic who studies public attitudes towards corruption. That was the easy part, and we found a lot of these academics. But when I asked them, well, what do you know about the way organized crime or white-collar criminals use corruption? And then, there was this really hiatus of knowledge that was not there. And I think one French academic provided me with my answer, probably, and another British academic, who basically their argument was that in white-collar criminals, in countries like France or Germany or the UK, are in a very different class, a social class, which is so remote from academics, and academics are so rarely allowed access to these elites, even criminal, not only criminal elites but economic elites, that it really and the state certainly doesn't provide any funding for research into the crimes of the elite, that it really deprives the academics from being able to do research on these issues. And we found hardly any countries in Europe where research on corruption was funded, and only in the past year the European Commission decided to give the first very big grant for a EU-wide study on corruption, a scientific grant for EU-wide study on corruption. And it was a similar situation we faced with in other countries where, in the UK, Dick Hobbs has argued that about the social class and the class differentiation of criminals and the connection between the proletarians or the working class and the organized crime. And again, he saw this as an impediment to academics to access and to do proper research on organized crime, because again, they came from a very different social background. They were in a different social circle that really didn't grant them access to do the type of almost anthropological study, that anthropological or ethnographic approach that you need to understand really how corruption works. Mm. Nevertheless, we were able to gather a team of seven or eight different criminologists and specialists in organized crime who had done some research on corruption and were willing to contribute to the study and to present how organized crime works in their countries. So the book is a little different from the study that we did for the European Commission, because it includes some additional chapters. For instance, we have a separate chapter on the UK by Sahooks and Achix of Oxford, and we have also a separate study on the country study on Russian organized crime and corruption, which was done by Teddy Rawlinson, who was formerly at the London School of Economics. these are some of the things that make the book different from the original report that we did for the European Commission.
Right, right. I mean, I have to concur with the things you're saying. Coming from Australia, we don't necessarily have a class system in the European sense, but we still have a great deal of trouble getting information. We're lucky that we have commissions of inquiry that put out transcripts, and it's mostly been inquiries into the police who are corrupt, and they regularly roll over and provide wonderful detail for criminological study, where they're asked questions of why did they join corruption or why did they participate in certain activity. What we're missing, I think, too, is still that idea of the ability to study the organized criminals themselves, because it's very, very hard, other than the criminals who actually effectively retire through imprisonment and then write their autobiographical material. We've almost got nothing that we can use for data.
Yeah. Even sometimes the police, the access to police data or the police information that existed was very fractured and didn't allow us to gather good information, particularly on the organized crime use of corruption. And the reason is that hardly any countries in the European Union have something like what the Serious Organized Crime Agency has in the UK, which is a specialized unit that examines how organized crime uses corruption in the UK. It publishes a biennial threat assessment on the use of corruption by organized crime, not publicly. But this type of concentrated knowledge and analysis and of someone that we can sit and speak with didn't exist simply across Europe. Most anti-corruption units or professional standards units that we saw across Europe very often had a mixture of work focusing either on police misbehavior and crime or kind of lower level police involvement in crime and corruption, but didn't really have this kind of concentrated and systematically analyzed information. So one of the approaches that we thought that we'll take was to go and talk to these anti-corruption units. But really what we found is that many of them simply had a very partial information that didn't give us the big picture. And even in the UK, the Serious Organized Crime Agency stopped at and their knowledge was pretty much limited to their understanding of organized crime. And when we spoke about white collar crime and the way, for instance, a big corruption scandal like the BA British Aerospace system scandal, where millions were given to Saudi princes to get a big contract. Defense contract. This type of and it was a very complex scheme of organized crime of organized corruption. This type of white collar crime didn't really fall within the Serious Organized Crime Agency responsibilities. Was part of the Serious Fraud Office. So even in the UK, you had kind of the elite crime, the elite corruption being investigated by the Serious Fraud Office. And kind of the more I guess the low level organized crime being investigated by the Serious Organized Crime Agency.
Right. So, what methods did you use to gather the data for this study? How did you go about it?
Well, we had basically a two-pronged approach. One was to go in depth in several countries, and in these countries, we hired local criminologists that had done research on organized crime for over a decade. We basically wanted they've developed and to use their connections. The knowledge that they had on the subject. We selected individuals whom we knew had access to such data, who have analyzed such data, but who simply didn't have a chance to publish it previously. And actually, in France, for instance, our expert at that time wasn't even comfortable publishing his name because he was working for a government institute, and he was pretty much afraid to speak publicly about this topic. And in the book, he decided to make his name public. For the other countries where we couldn't find experts, which was the majority of the countries, we simply decided to go with in-depth interviews. The task was how to design kind of sample of experts. That is because we had to do less than between 5 and 10 interviews per country. We pretty much had to do a kind of the Delphi approach, where we do a survey of experts, but we did it through in-depth interviews rather than through submitting them with questionnaires and so forth. And in each country, we wanted to find five experts, either from prosecutors or independent academics or journalists. Or other experts, private sector fraud investigators, lawyers, this type of people to speak to us about corruption. And I have to say that in some countries, it was even difficult to find such people ready to agree to speak to us. Cyprus was, I guess, the most difficult place. Where we wrote to several academics, we wrote to several journalists, and it was still difficult. And we decided to take and I guess because it's a very small country, everyone knows everyone. People just didn't feel comfortable even when we promised them to be the interviews to be anonymous. They didn't feel comfortable without knowing us to speak to us. This is something, by the way, which the European Commission by allowing us to do anonymous interviews, which they usually don't because they want to make sure that they know who the contractor spoke to. That really helped for the study to have a better value because most people simply didn't feel comfortable revealing their names. On this issue. And in Cyprus, we were actually forced to go and look to diplomats and law enforcement liaison officers whom we knew had an external view, but yet from sitting in the country and working with the law enforcement communities and working on organized crime cases, they had some knowledge about corruption. And this was our substitute. Basically for not being able to find local experts willing to speak to us.
Right,
in other countries, we, for instance, in Luxembourg. Luxembourg is, it's reputed to have the reputation of a kind of a tax haven, a place where a lot of white-collar crime kind of uses as an intermediary place or as an important base. And there, every government official that we spoke to said simply that there isn't organized crime or corruption. Very similar to Cyprus. From the Cypriot police, we got an official letter saying that there was no information that organized crime in Cyprus uses any corruption. And for that matter, another letter came from a prosecutor claiming that there is no organized crime in Cyprus.
Excellent. Wonderful place to live then.
Yeah. So we had all these official statements, and this type of statements were not simply statements that they send, because we said this is a study from the Director General Home Affairs of the European Commission. They want to know. We didn't say at that time that the study will be public, because it was up to the member states at the end to decide if the study wants to be public. We said this is a study for the European Commission. We don't want to the interviews and the data you provide will be anonymized. It's not going to be made public. And still we got these letters. And none of these countries ever releases public reports or any form of public accountability to inform the public in the country about the state of corruption and organized crime. And in all of them, when we went to our alternative sources, of course, we came up with significant and various information on the issue. For instance, in the case of Cyprus, when we started digging through media and to talk to we spoke to a journalist there as well and to the foreign diplomats, and it came out that Cyprus, for instance, was for a long time an important kind of launch pad for illegal cigarette smuggling into the European Union, and until a few years ago, when Cyprus decided not to be this launch pad, a number of international cigarette companies had their factories, their manufacturing facilities, and they were producing 10 times more than what the Cypriot population could could consume in cigarettes. And what we found out that a relative to the prosecutor, to the Attorney General of Cyprus, was basically involved and controlled the production of one particular brand of cigarettes, which was smuggled into the European Union. We found that the head of the Cypriot immigration migration police was also arrested on charges of corruption.
I just want to inform our listeners that we had a technical breakdown and that we're restarting the interview. So, Philip, well, we were talking about Cyprus, and now I think we're moving on to the discussion of countries that were in denial about their corruption and organized crime problems.
Yep. In our communication, in the types of interviews that we were trying to do to get the best information on this very sensitive issue, we had a lot of denial that we came across, and it came certainly from the government interviewees that we try and the institutions that we try to approach. And of course, our main focus was to try to get to corruption investigation police departments or to prosecutors who investigate corruption. But we initially we got a lot of negative answers. For instance, from Cyprus, we received letters claiming that there wasn't really any organized crime or any proof that whatever organized crime exists didn't use corruption. Similarly, we had a interview with a high level of French prosecutor responsible for overseeing anti-corruption policies, and he similarly claimed that in France there was serious crime, but it was somehow disorganized and we couldn't really speak about organized crime. And something we came across many countries was they were trying to use all sorts of euphemisms to speak about the issue of corruption and organized crime. And of course, we see that in many police departments where they usually talk about professional standards or they talk about misconduct, and the word corruption is always being avoided. And even we came across discrepancies. For instance, it was an interesting case when we in France the official information they provided us with was that there were 20 cases of police corruption in the year when we carried out the study. At the same time, in the UK, there were hundreds of cases of corruption that were registered, and we were trying to get a sense of who used what definition of corruption, and it seemed that some countries were so much trying to, and France was one of them, was so much trying to avoid the use of word corruption that they had such very narrow definitions that pretty much registered no cases of corruption. And coming back to the case of Cyprus, when we tried to find alternative sources of information across, of course, we came about across various cases of high level officials, including a relative of the prosecutor general who was involved in the illegal cigarette trade, or the head of the immigration unit who was facilitating illegal migration. And Cyprus was, of course, a major tourist destination with a lot of sex and drug trade, and we certainly found that the local police was very and local government was very often closely involved with local businessmen who controlled this trade.
Do you think that this is an official policy, or is it just an avoidance issue where people just don't want to approach the issue of corruption? Is it because they want to disguise it, or is it because they don't want to deal with it?
It's taken the European Union a long time to come to an agreement and on dealing with the issue of corruption, and it's only really in the next year that for the first time the European Union is taking a step as a whole to start looking at the issue of corruption. So far, it was really the attention was always focused on Eastern Europe, the new member states. In the last couple of years, particularly Bulgaria and Romania, who were subject to a special monitoring on corruption and organized crime, to assess if they're fit to join the common EU border area, the Schengen area. Mm-hmm. But the issue of it's part of the partially the problem is that internal affairs and police matters have been traditionally a national the so-called third pillar, or a national issue that the European Union didn't really have any word in how to deal with, and there were no common standards, anti-corruption standards, or anything of that sort, unlike any other public policy area in the EU. And with the new Lisbon Treaty, which came into force a couple of years ago, this has changed, and now there is this new push to come up with a common definition of at least what type of crimes come under corruption, as well as to start monitoring corruption. But I think what we'll see is, again, countries will probably try to narrow down the definition and both of corruption and of organized crime, because we have, of course, countries like the UK where they're in control of the offshore zone regulations of the Cayman Islands or the Jersey and all these other offshore areas which the UK Treasury controls, and which inevitably come involved in laundering proceeds of corruption from corrupt leaders across the world. And I'm sure they will make everything possible to stop any kind of monitoring to go beyond these very sensitive issues. And I think even higher level corruption mechanism, something that Larry Lessig at Harvard has called the institutional corruption, or kind of the legalized form of corrupt influence that political parties or businesses have, this will probably stay still outside something that the European Union will try to monitor, because I'm sure many member states will oppose to this.
So it'll be a lowest common denominator situation.
Yeah, most likely, just like the United Nations Corruption Convention, which I've attended a lot of these discussions where you see country member representatives from very corrupt countries trying to make sure that there isn't really any real monitoring. And that's what we see in most member states, a denial of corruption and really a justification of why very little anti-corruption measures are in place, because they say, well, there is no corruption, why should we have any anti-corruption measures, which becomes sort of a catch-22, because then they uncover less corruption, which feeds into the kind of their story that there isn't any corruption. And well, this is something that we saw especially across Nordic countries, which are, of course, at the top of all corruption indices as the least corrupt countries. And this is we saw very little anti-corruption activities or measures taking place. And corruption is just presumed not to be there. Which actually makes the whole presumption quite questionable, because when you think that there are common EU borders, and these we have basically one common EU borders, much like the United States has, and if criminals try to enter, they will at some point try to go through the border that poses the least risks, and this would be the border that has the least anti-corruption measures. So in the long run, unless there is some type of unification of standards, we can see even these non-corrupt countries coming under great pressure from international criminals.
Right. I mean, that is one of the great dilemmas in research in corruption. If you find a lot of corruption, does that mean there is more corruption than somewhere else, or were you just looking better? Did you have a better method of discovering corruption? So it's very hard to determine how much you've actually uncovered as opposed to how much is really there.
Yeah. Now, well, we certainly saw in our research some big differences, especially when it came to judicial corruption. In Western Europe, there were really countries where we tried to speak to lawyers, to former prosecutors, and just independent analysts, and no one could really remember the last time of really a traditional type of graft or corruption, where a judge especially, but even prosecutors, which are more, of course, vulnerable to corruption than judges, were convicted or investigated for corruption, which in Eastern Europe there were, and even Greece, there were just dozens of cases annually that were being investigated. Very similar for political corruption, where in Western Europe really this connection between traditional forms of organized crime like drug trafficking and prostitution very rarely connected in some way to the top political elite. The top political elite was usually involved in some kind of, we could see there, the white-collar crime connection. But in Eastern Europe, even these top political levels and members of parliament, not only in Eastern Europe, but also in Italy, were very much involved with basically traditional forms of organized crime.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I found the same thing in Australia. The politicians and the police have completely separate corruption networks. They don't overlap very often. And this brings us nicely to the topic of tobacco, which I understand you rate as, certainly the book says you rate as one of the largest criminal activities, the smuggling of tobacco and excise avoidance.
This particularly in Europe has been a growing issue over the last decade, because the European Union has introduced a type of a taxation, common taxation policies on excisable goods that is, in my opinion, not very well thought out, and it is bringing the EU, especially the Eastern European land borders, to a situation very similar to the prohibition era in the United States, and it reminds us of the Canadian-US border in the beginning of last century, where we see mass quantities of smuggling of cigarettes in every possible way, and all sorts of local people and entrepreneurs being involved in the smuggling. Big illegal markets in several countries in along the eastern European border. We see countries with 30 to 40% of illegal cigarettes market. Pretty much very, very few countries in Europe have illegal markets that are less than 10% of the overall cigarettes market. And even big countries like Germany have over 20% of cigarettes sold there are illicit, which creates a multi-billion dollar industry. And that industry especially in Eastern European countries has overtaken the illegal drug trade, because they're heavy smokers and not traditionally big drug users. So the cigarette market, the illicit cigarette market has attracted even a lot of drug dealers and drug smugglers who now find it more profitable and less risky, because it overlaps often with the legitimate markets. We find a lot of legitimate companies that are also being involved in the illegal cigarette trade. Not only the big international tobacco companies have for a long time been blamed for being at the heart of it, but after certain measures, now they're supposed to pay fines for each box of illegal cigarettes that of their brand that is being smuggled and found inside the European Union. But there are a lot of smaller producers and a lot of illegal producers across the EU that are now fueling the illicit tobacco trade. But it's pretty much companies in the Middle East and the former Soviet Union that provide and in China, which produces counterfeit cigarettes, that fuel the big illicit tobacco trade. And this is bound to stay for the next and probably to increase, particularly in Eastern Europe, because Eastern European countries are supposed to bring their excise taxation to the levels of Western Europe, which will make illicit cigarettes even more expensive for consumers in Eastern Europe. And even the EU is pushing countries on the periphery of the European Union, like Moldova or the former Soviet republics or former Yugoslav republics, to increase their excise taxes and basically pushing them into creating big legal markets there as well, based on the presumption that if somehow everyone has high excise tax levels, the illicit market will disappear.
That can work internally. In Australia, where we only have 20 million people, we have massive profits from tobacco smuggling, where $20,000 will fill a container full of raw tobacco and the Philippines, and then you can sell it for $1 to $2 million with very, very, very low penalties, maybe a fine.
Yeah. Yeah, the penal policies are also another issue that is slowly, very slowly catching up because it's still considered at the low level of illicit drug trade, of illicit cigarette trade, it's just considered an administrative offense.
Yes.
So retailers, including little small stores or even street dealers, you cannot really do anything about them. At the middle levels is where the most of the real illicit trade is going on, because on the import and very often at the production level, it's usually legal. So we have just a very small kind of window of opportunity to tackle the illegal trade. But the main thing is that in a country like Bulgaria or in a lot of the Eastern European countries, which are vulnerable to corruption because they don't have very strong law enforcement or judiciary to start with, it creates a huge amount of funds that are used to corrupt both street-level police officers as well as border guards, as well as customs officers. And because of the involvement of legitimate companies, we see a lot of evidence of politicians at various levels being involved in the illicit tobacco trade or supporting it, either through trying to even pass legislation that facilitates it in some way. For instance, in Bulgaria and Romania, which are some of the main entry points for illicit tobacco into the EU, the duty-free shops along the land borders for many years were used as a smuggling venue, smuggling point for all sorts of excisable goods. And they have because these stores are also legitimate and they exist on the airports and so forth, the European Union forced all EU member states to close land border duty-free shops because they were used as smuggling points. But all these industries, because they're legitimate, they have their strong lobbies and they continually lobby for reopening these stores, which inevitably will revive this trade. In Bulgaria, for instance, we estimated that about 30% of cigarettes sold in the country were sold through a couple of dozen duty-free shops on these external land borders.
Wow.
It created at the land border crossings, the duty-free shops, and the pressure from smuggling created such a corrupt atmosphere that it still continues. Just 2 weeks ago, about 30 customs officers were apprehended, and a dozen of them were arrested for being involved facilitating smuggling.
Is there any estimate of how much money is being lost to taxation through all of this?
But I think that because of the lack of clear understanding of how much the illegal market is, these are underestimated, because the official estimation for the EU is 10 billion euros. But that's having seen how this estimate is made, I think it's significantly underestimated, because only in a very, very small market like the Bulgarian one, we're talking about a little less than half a billion euro. Yeah. So for a big market like Germany's, where you have 20% of it being illegal trade, and it's probably even more. Because some countries invested heavily in tackling the illicit cigarette market, and it's very expensive to deal with it. And the UK invested tens of millions of pounds over a few years to try to reduce it and suppress it. And for the UK, it's probably easier because it's an island and the protection of the borders, it's easier. But along the land borders, where you have literally from old grandmothers going across the border and buying cheap cigarettes on the other side and bringing them back to truckloads and going through. We literally have a container trucks going through the green borders, through logging roads, through the forest, smuggling cigarettes. It has become, yeah, as I said, really like the prohibition era in the U.S.
Yeah, I've read a couple of articles, journal articles about tobacco smuggling in Europe, and they point out that many of the people who are involved are actually not criminal organizations, but someone has an uncle who drives trucks across Europe, and he's always bringing back cigarettes for the family and all their friends. So it's actually, there's a lot of low-level operation of smuggling.
Now, for instance, the Bulgarian state railway companies had difficult time finding replacement train drivers because all of them had been banned for smuggling cigarettes from neighboring Serbia, because about 40 of them that worked along this border, all of them had been registered for smuggling cigarettes. So now they had to move people from other parts of the country because they had clean, basically criminal records to drive the train across borders.
But then they themselves might get their own criminal records once the opportunity arises.
Yeah, I'm sure that that'll be the case.
We're running out of time, and I really do appreciate the time you've spent talking to me. So we'll move on to the next question, which, of course, is what are you going to be working on next? So you finished this book, and I understand you've been doing the study of border guards as well.
Yeah, I guess building upon this research that we did for the European Commission, the European Border Agency, Frontex, asked us to do research on corruption and the anti-corruption measures in border guards across the EU, which pretty much turned into a study of studying police corruption in the EU, because a lot of the border guard duties are carried out by regular police in most of Europe. And it's been quite fascinating to see how dynamic the corruption situation was and how the economic crisis influenced some of the corruption patterns, because some of the illicit markets, the sex trade market, which a lot of police officers were exposed to, or the drugs market, had shrunk in revenues. On the other hand, the illicit tobacco market had grown, and particularly border guards, but also police patrols were very much exposed and had become involved. And we saw really cases across all Europe that involved the corrupt police officers being complicit in the smuggling of tobacco. So that's that report is about to become public shortly.
Wonderful, wonderful. So if anyone was listening and they wanted to see a copy of the report, where would they look?
Our website, of the Center for the Study of Democracy, would probably post it. It's www.csd.bg, the Center for the Study of Democracy. But the Frontex website will probably also feature it once it's public.
Excellent, excellent. I might be able to update our website as well with a link to it as well. Well, thank you very much, Philip, for talking to me today. And all the best with the new report and whatever comes after that. I'm sure you'll keep moving on to even bigger and greater things.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Philip Gunev discuss his new book, Corruption and Organized Crime in Europe. I'm Mark Locks, the co-host of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. Thank you for listening.